Well, welcome everybody to the latest episode of Stars, Cells, and God. This is the show where we discuss how the latest discoveries in science provide evidence for God's existence, the reliability of Scripture, and the credibility of the Christian worldview. My name is Fuzz Rana. I am a biochemist and a Christian apologist, and I work for an organization called Reasons to Believe. This is the organization that sponsors this podcast, and we depend upon people who support our ministry at Reasons to Believe to be able to fund this podcast. So please consider how you might contribute. If you want to know more about Reasons to Believe, go to our website, reasons.org. And also you can follow us on social media, RTB_official. And then finally, go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, and subscribe. There you can get some great content that addresses a wide range of science faith issues. And then finally, use the notification button so you can be alerted when the next episode of Star Cells and God drops. I'm joined in studio today with Dr. Jeff Zwirink, who is an astrophysicist and a Christian apologist, part of the team here at Reasons to Believe. And Jeff's going to talk about just right water, and I'm going to talk a little bit about endogenous retroviruses. So, Jeff, why don't you open us up?
Well, no, I appreciate that. And I just, you know, I was thinking about just right water, and, you know, again, this whole Goldilocks idea. And, you know, what does it mean for the just right water? And what I, the particular discovery I've came across and reading about it just to me demonstrates the remarkable engineering, if you will, of God and how he's not only set up the universe, but in terms of Earth's development, the things that are critical for hosting life. So, I mean, you ask the question, what is it that's just critical for life? And everybody would answer, well, water. You got to have water. There's no doubt about that. And I love the point that Hugh makes is that we tend to think of the Earth as water rich. And in reality, the Earth is water poor for planets that have water on them. And it's actually the balance between those two that this more recent discovery is elucidating, because if you have too much water, what you have is you miss out on the another key component to life, or at least the kind of diversity of life that we see on Earth, and that is continents. Because you can have water that is so deep that the continents never grow above it. I mean, you know, we have about 70% water or 70% oceans, 30% water on the Earth. And if you, raise the water level too much, you know, you end up just getting the very peaks of the mountains there. And really, those are relying on continents. There's a whole slew of things that go into that. But I think I investigated and tried to study once, and I think about somewhere between 65 to 70% of all life on Earth resides either on the continents or in the continental margins. So as critical as water is, and I no doubt about that, if you're talking about the diversity of life that we see on Earth, you need to have something like continents. And so if you have too much water, the continents remain submerged. That has a tremendous influence on the development of the planet. If you don't have enough water, all you have is land, and you don't have the oceans, and so you don't have the water cycle. And, you know, coupled in with plate tectonics, which is what generates the continents, kind of once plate tectonics stops, the water evaporates. Once water is gone, plate tectonics stops. They're kind of tied together. You need to have both, kind of like the water is a little bit of the oil that keeps the engine running on plate tectonics. And so what's interesting about this study is that they go along here, and I'll just show up the title there. It says, it's constraining the volume of Earth's early oceans with a temperature-dependent mantle water storage capacity model. And specifically what they're looking at is how much water is there on Earth, and where is it located? And we know we can quantify the amount of water on the surface of the Earth, but yet we think there's a significant amount of water interior to the Earth. And, you know, you typically think of water dissolving things, but, you know, at least in some sort of loose measure, at higher temperatures and pressures, rocks can dissolve water. And so that's kind of what they're getting at here. Is, you know, as water is subducted and water is mixed in, how much of that water can remain inside the interior of the Earth and how much is stuck on surface? And as it seems like the answer is kind of around, given the amount of water in Earth's oceans, somewhere to 2 to 3 times the amount of that water is stored inside the Earth today. And what this study in particular is looking at is asking the question, if the Earth was hotter in the past, which we expect, especially in the interior, although Earth's surface has largely been the same temperature, but it would be hotter in the interior, what does that do? Mm-hmm. You know, at least for most things, the hotter you get, the more things can absorb mm-hmm. and how that plays out. It turns out with water, it's kind of backwards of that. Mm-hmm. And so if you kind of go to the next slide there, just to get a general picture here, we've got the Earth, you've got this crust on the outside that's on the order of 100 miles deep, something mm-hmm. like that. Then you've got below that, you've got the asthenosphere and the upper part of the mantle, which goes down to about 600 miles. And then there's a lower mantle, which is more stiff. And then you get down below the mantle. I think I had the actual, so the crust is about, I made a mistake. Crust is about 30 kilometers deep. The upper mantle goes from 30 kilometers down to about 660 kilometers. The lower mantle goes from 660 kilometers about to 2,900 kilometers. And then the core is from 2,900 kilometers down to 6,400 kilometers. So if you do the calculations in there, that lower mantle between 660 kilometers down to 2,900 kilometers, that's about 50% of Earth's volume. Mm-hmm. And it's the largest component, the largest single component of Earth's volume in there. And so this study is looking at how do these water-absorbing rocks behave in that volume, because mm-hmm. that's going to be the dominant component. And it turns out inside that volume, there is one mineral that is the dominant component of the lower mantle, and that's a material called bridgmanite. Mm-hmm. And as I was kind of investigating and studying what all this means, there's this cool feature of minerals that they're polymorphic, which means that even though they have the same chemical composition, as pressures and temperatures go up, they will assume different crystalline structures. Mm-hmm. And so the particular one that ends up in this bridgmanite is, if you go look kind of closer to the surface, you've got olivine. That's this cool green-looking one. Mm-hmm. I like shiny rock pictures, crystal pictures. These are kind of cool. In fact, we were out at the National I'm drawing a blank, the National History Museum out in Washington, D.C., and there's this whole room just full of shiny crystal stuff. And my daughter and I were just like, oh, that's a cool one. Take a picture. Ooh, that's a cool one. So I got like probably 50 pictures of inside that room itself. But my daughter says, ooh, shiny stuff. So, so this olivine is one of the dominant minerals in Earth's upper part in the crust. But as pressures increase down to about 400, or we get down around 400 kilometers below the Earth, this now gets, just because of the temperature and pressures, transformed into that middle one, which I think is Wadsleyite. Mm-hmm. I got to say, geologists came up with some really cool names. I'm assuming that's a last name, probably, is what that is. But
somebody named Wadsley discovered it.
And then if you go even deeper, pressures and temperatures continue to go up. It transforms into woodringite. And you see there, you know, whereas this olivine, you know, that's just a nice crystal or very much clearer picture. These other, you know, it's 50 microns across, which is, you know, like about 50 times the width of a human hair. So this is not really large stuff. Uh-huh. The reason being is to make these sorts of things, you have to have these intense pressures. And so you make them, and then once you take them out, they're going to revert back to the other structure. So you can see these almost look like microscope pictures, whereas this mm-hmm. one's over here. And then so you get to the ringwoodite down to about 500 kilometers. And then as the pressures continue to increase, when you get down to 660 kilometers, which is the transition from the upper mantle down to the lower mantle, that's when you now convert into this bridgmanite. And so, you know, one, I just think that's really cool. So I thought it was worth articulating a little bit. But now, so the question is, bridgmanite is the dominant component of the lower mantle. The lower mantle is arguably the dominant component of Earth's water storage capacity. As you get down into this region, what happens to the capacity of this region to store water? And if you go on to the next slide, so they were doing various models of this, and this is kind of the bottom line or the result of the study. You can see there, both of these are plotting water storage capacity, and you'll notice that it's the Wadsleyite on the left there and the Ringwoodite on the right. It's not entirely clear to me why they didn't do the Bridgmanite, except it's probably impossible to work with that just because of the temperatures and pressures, would be my guess. But you know, you notice they're very similar in what they look like here. And the key feature of this is that if you look at the temperature or how the water storage capacity changes as the temperature changes, you notice that they have two ranges on this plot where this T sub P is either 1600 Kelvin or 1900 Kelvin. Well, 1600 Kelvin is today's value. And you'll notice that at 1600 Kelvin, the water has, or the these minerals have a much higher water storage capacity. Whereas if you go up to 1900, it drops by something on the order of a factor of 2, which means that the amount of water stored inside the Earth would be much less at those higher temperatures. Why that particular temperature is chosen is that would be a temperature more similar or more akin to the ancient Archean Earth, you know, 3 to 4 billion years ago. Which means, bottom line on all that, is that our ocean, if we have the same amount of water on Earth, and to a good approximation, there is probably the same amount of water. We lose a little bit to evaporation because of various processes that happen, and you get comets that come in. So to first order, the amount of water is pretty much constant over this time. But the amount of water that can be stored in Earth's interior is dramatically higher now than it was when the Earth was formed. And there's kind of two interesting features of that. One is that as geologists and geophysicists look at some of the more ancient rocks on the Earth, I mean, you've got these zircons that date back to 4 billion years ago, and there's evidence that they were formed in a liquid water environment. You've got pillow basalts where lava is coming up from the ground or coming up and entering into an aqueous environment, and it forms these pillow lavas. You got oxygen isotopes measured in, these are all from 3 to 4 billion years ago in Australia, Australia, Greenland, where, you know, that's where you tend to find these 3 to 4 billion year old sections of Earth's crust. All of these show evidence of being submerged in water. And if you think through the implications of, okay, we look at what the surface of Earth is today, it's about 70% oceans, 30% continents. Some of those continents are quite high. You know, you got mountains that extend up to close to 30,000 feet or about 6 miles. The oceans tend to be on the order of a couple miles deep. You now take the water that we have on the surface of the Earth and say, all right, there's about somewhere around 2 to 2.5 times that amount of water inside the Earth. Well, if you now reduce the capacity of the interior of the Earth to absorb water, that almost a full ocean's worth of water is now up on the surface of the Earth. So instead of being a couple miles deep, the Earth's oceans are 4 to 5 miles deep, which, given that a lot of Earth's land is below 2 miles above sea level, you take anything below 6,000 feet, or no, actually, take anything below 10,000 feet, and that's now submerged.
Yeah.
And so, and particularly even before plate tectonics had started happening, all of these really tall mountains aren't going to be there. Interesting biblical implication. You start out in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void. You know, I know that has this connotation of hostile to life, but formless and void, that there's not this continents, plants, or you know, land and structure. And darkness is over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. So the Bible describes the earth covered in liquid water.
Right.
Well, this research is showing how in the early earth, we would have expected to be entirely covered in water.
Right.
And so I just find it fascinating that it's like, not only do we see support for the biblical description of the early Earth, but we also see how critical, if Earth had about double the amount of water, we may never have had any continents on the Earth. And if it would have had much less water, and we're already pretty water poor, we would have had no oceans on the Earth. And so we seem to have just the right amount to not only make sure that we've got abundant continents and oceans today, but also that process that's going to form those oceans and continents today works efficiently throughout the history of the Earth. And too much water would have prevented that from happening.
So as the Earth, you know, transpires in age, there's a cooling that takes place
right.
in the interior, which then draws more water in. So that process is essentially supporting the growth of the continental land masses. So both things are happening at the same time, right?
Right, yeah. So the heat in the interior of the Earth drives plate tectonics, which allows the continents to grow. And we don't see – or we kind of see episodes of continental growth. Yeah. I think that's about 3.3 billion years ago. There's a couple in the two and a couple – an episode in the 1 billion year range.
Yeah.
I forget the exact numbers, but you know, these kinds of episodes. So not only do you see continent building happening from plate tectonics, but there's this commensurate effect, which is necessary or else it won't work, in that the amount of water on the surface of the Earth is also being absorbed into the interior of the Earth. So the water level on the surface of the Earth is going down, so the continents can now peak up above.
Yeah. Yeah,
which from an engineering perspective, it's like here yeah. you've got these two things that work hand in hand, that the heat that drives the plate tectonics, and as the heat dissipates through the surface of the Earth, that's also pulling the water down. It's like you've got this same heat source right. driving two effects that make it happen. And
yeah,
that's just, like I said, I think it's just kind of cool. So.
Yeah. Well, it's remarkable, yeah, that you have that kind of a coincidence where everything is happening in the just right way,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the just right combination.
Right, it really is. And that's one thing I'm learning to appreciate more and more with how the Earth works. It's not just that God made this planet and it was perfect the way it was. It was like, you know, all along he's in there knowing the process. Right. So it's not like, okay, God, well, that didn't quite work. I'm going to have to fix it. But it's like he set things up so that these laws of physics that he right. upholds creation so reliably they result from, that those the way the physics works here on Earth results in this elegant process that
right.
allows some life forms to come about, early life forms, and then mm-hmm. as you get continents, that actually mm-hmm. changes the types of organisms that are there, and these organisms change the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and the atmosphere changes. You know, it's all this...
Mm-hmm.
It's not life just responding to what's there, that as the changes happen, life adapts to, and then life actually drives the changes
yeah.
that happen as well. And so it's this, rather than life just kind of, well, this kind of life can be there and God creates it, it's God's using the life among all of this to, the term I would use for it is a great symphony.
Yeah.
You know, you're not just there with the drums, you've got the drums and the trombones and the winds and they all making this beautiful thing to listen to. That's the way it looks like on the Earth. And,
yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, going back to the Genesis 1 creation account, you know, as you're mentioning Genesis 1, 2, it talks about the Earth being formless and empty, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
So there's no form and there's nothing is filling the Earth.
Right.
And so, you know, one view of Genesis 1 is the framework view that argues, well, the first 3 days are giving form to the Earth, and then the next 3 days, you know, those forms are now being filled.
Right.
Right. So I think there's some merit to the framework view, even though we would hold to a day-age view. I think there's some merit to that approach. But, you know, in light of what you're describing here, it's not that God just created the Earth in a mature form
mm-hmm.
and then populated it with life. There appears to be a process
right.
in which it goes from being formless to actually having habitats that are generated
mm-hmm.
through process so that now life can populate the Earth in various different, you know, locales.
Right.
So you know, the biblical text seems to imply this process, this sequence
yes.
where things are unfolding, you know, in a very deliberate manner
mm-hmm.
as God's bringing about his creative purposes. Or you see the same type of idea in Psalm 104, which
right.
is a creation account that corresponds to Genesis 1, where the text seems to have a discussion of what the earth was like before God mm-hmm. did an act of creation, then he completes it. And then the psalmist reflects upon, well, what does that mean?
Right.
You know, for his providential care, but then it's also setting the stage for what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that that's how Scripture is describing the process of Earth's history and life's history.
Right. Well, you know, you made a comment that, you know, the framework has some interesting features. We take a day-age view, and there's actually a reflection of what I'm talking about in that. It's like, yes, I think the framework, right? I do think it's a day-age view where, you know, here's the early Earth, and then this is the sequence of events that happen. And I think the framework would say, no, this isn't necessarily a sequence. It's just describing God making form and then filling the forms, if you will. But I don't see why you have to have one or the other, because I look at it, it's like, yeah, there is this making the form, and then there's also the filling. And it's like, why can't you have both, where God is not only providing the framework, but also the history as well? And it does it remarkably well. I mean, I remember when I first read the framework, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of theological structure in Genesis that I never appreciated. But it doesn't negate, or it doesn't, that doesn't stand in contradiction to the history of this being a chronology. It just adds to it. And that's kind of what I see here. It's like, not that continent growth wasn't important and it happens by subduction and all these sorts of things that we know how continents form, but we also see this other part in here. It's like, oh, not only are we building continents, we're also removing water so those continents can stick up. Yeah. It's a both and type thing. And I see that in Scripture too, which is fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I, like you, I would hold to, broadly speaking, a day-age view. But I think there are clearly elements of the framework view that have credibility. Right. I also think that Genesis 1 is functioning as a polemic against the ancient Near Eastern creation myths, you know, and is setting up a very different kind of worldview. So there's all kinds of things going on in Genesis 1. It's an incredibly rich passage of Scripture that I think we oftentimes fail to fully appreciate.
Yes.
You know.
Well, and to the point of, I'll toot my horn a little bit here. I remember we were giving, back when we had, I think it was Message of the Month was the name of the particular program we had at the time, but was preparing one of these, and I think RTB had published 10 books at the time. And so I remember going through, and it was like I found a couple of places where the titles of the books just naturally fit in with my talk. And so as I was giving the talk, I put the names of every book we'd made in the talk. And I've done that once, because that was the only time where I kind of saw how it worked. And even then I had to kind of push and shove a little bit for a couple of them. But this idea that one creation account could be serving as a framework of what God's doing, as well as a historical account of what God did, as well as a polemic against ancient Near Eastern thought, that really does speak to the elegance and the sophistication of the literature there. And I just, it's not like we just see that in God's special revelation, but I think we see it in God's general revelation as well.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing stuff.
It really is. So. Well, I just think I think the bottom line, in fact, this is what one of the authors of the study goes, said, if asteroids, this is a quote, if the asteroids had deposited twice as much water on the present-day mantle had less appetite for water than the continent, so essential for planets, life, and climate, would never have emerged.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like we do see this fine-tuning that we've got to have enough water but not too much water. And, you know, it's kind of Hughes Ballywick in his ministry here. It's like the Earth is just right, and we see another piece of evidence in favor of that.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's change gears and just to kind of ease us into the discovery, I'm going to see if you're interested in weighing in on a controversy that takes place in my house.
Okay.
My wife loves antiques.
Right.
And if you come to our home, there's antiques everywhere. She uses antiques to decorate. There's antique furniture. And, you know, and maybe that's a good thing, because as I'm getting old and, you know, becoming a bit of an antique myself, I'm glad that my wife likes antiques. But, you know, for my wife, she sees treasures, right, in these antiques, whereas a lot of times I just see junk, right, broken down stuff that used to perform a function but doesn't anymore. Some of it's rusty, you know, and so the question is, are antiques a treasure or are antiques junk? And I'm just curious how you would weigh in on that controversy. And here's a picture to kind of inspire us, you know, as we talk about.
I was curious, is this an antique store?
Yes,
or is this closer to home?
No, this antique store. Not quite that cluttered at our house. But
well, to me, that's, I guess, the struggle I have with that is you could have so much stuff that it's cluttered, or you could have stuff that tells a story, or even though the original piece isn't doing what it's supposed to, it still performs a function, tells a story, does something in there. And so I think I'm less concerned about do you collect as to how you collect. If you hoard, that's probably not a good thing. If you just throw everything away, you probably miss some of the important things you're supposed to remember.
Yeah.
So
I'll
be diplomatic there in my answer.
Yeah, well, you know, my wife's decoration is very careful.
Right.
So there's a rhyme and a reason for everything. And actually, I'm joking here, I actually do appreciate, you know, a lot of the antiques,
right,
because they do tell a story. Mm-hmm. They represent history. But
the hard part is some of the things that are starting to show up in antique store were there when I was – those things I played with as a kid.
Yeah. Tell me about it. But this whole idea, is something treasure or is something junk, is actually a debate that takes place in molecular biology with respect to genomes of organisms, mm-hmm, right? And so here's a typical diagram that you might see cataloging the different types of DNA sequences that are found in this case, in the human genome. But this would be applicable to other mammals as well, mm-hmm, other organisms, not just simply mammals, where there's a very large proportion of the genome that seems to be made up of DNA sequences that don't appear to serve any purpose whatsoever.
And so this would be just kind of a more detailed expansion of there's DNA that codes for genes, and then there's DNA that does other stuff. So some of that may have function, or some of that may be labeled as, okay, it does this, but it's just articulating all of that other stuff as well.
Right, and you know, and oftentimes the way people perceive the genome is that, well, in the human genome, as an example, 2% of the genome codes for proteins. There's some percentage, very small, that consists of regulatory elements that mm-hmm regulate the expression of those proteins. But then, by and large, most of it looks like it's junk. Some of it are pseudogenes, which were once functional genes that then became disabled. That's about 2% of the genome. But a vast proportion seems to be derived from viral sequences.
Okay.
So viral infections. Some of them are things like line and sine DNA, long interspersed nuclear elements and short interspersed nuclear elements. And those are sequences derived from retroviral infections, presumably.
So that's where in there a virus infects us and somehow its DNA gets incorporated into the host DNA and then is passed on as well.
Yes.
In some sort of, whether original form or broken form. Okay.
Right. But the signs are, in a sense, in lines are considered to be derivatives of, that it's after the infection happens, there's other biochemical events that create those sequences.
Gotcha.
But there's also, as you're pointing out, what are called endogenous retroviruses. These are sequences that, for the most part, are still the remnants of a retroviral infection. And this constitutes about 10% of the human genome and typically about 10% of most mammalian genomes. And just so
the 10% is the signs and the lines and the endogenous
retroviruses? No, the signs and lines are much more.
Okay. Yeah. So the endogenous retroviruses are the 10%.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there's also these sequences called long terminal repeats that are also believed to be derived from retroviruses.
Okay.
Some people classify them as retroviruses. Others see them as derivatives.
Gotcha.
But, you know, the idea here is that most of the genome has been shaped by viral infections. And this is a cartoon showing what a retrovirus is and how a retrovirus DNA gets incorporated into the host genome. So here we see the viral capsid interacting with the cell membrane, and as a result, there is a fusion where the bacterial cell envelope, or the bacterial envelope fuses with the host envelope, and as a result, you have the virus capsid entering into the cell. Mm-hmm. That capsid dissolves away, and now you have genetic material, which is RNA in the case of a retrovirus. And then that there are some enzymes that will convert the RNA into DNA, and then mm-hmm. that DNA can then direct the production of RNA particles that can be translated by the ribosomes to produce viral proteins, and then also that RNA can also then be encapsulated within the viral proteins to form the viral capsids. So one particle infecting a cell then can, you know, replicate multiple times to produce a large number right. of particles that then are released, you know, and can infect other tissue or be spread from one host to mm-hmm. another person.
I do have to say that's pretty slick that the virus comes in and uses the host machinery to replicate itself. Yep. I mean, that's pretty slick.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's insidious. It's a malevolent, an elegant, ingenious, malevolent design. But, you know, now some of the DNA that results from the process of reverse transcription can actually be integrated into the host genome. That process is called endogenization. And there, that viral genetic material can remain active, or it can go into a latency stage okay. where it can then later on be reactivated. So this slide is showing how retroviral infections can be transmitted, and they can either occur horizontally or vertically. And so horizontally would be, I have a retroviral infection and I sneeze and it pick up some of the viral particles. Now you have that infection. So okay. that's a horizontal transmission from host to host. But because the retroviruses can become endogenized, if that endogenization happens in gametes, egg cells, or sperm cells, it means that there's also a vertical transmission where now the child, the offspring, mm-hmm. are going to have that viral infection. And in turn, their children will have that viral infection. So that's called a vertical transmission.
Do we see that happening, or do we just infer that that's happened because of the DNA signature?
It's an inference.
It's an inference. Yes,
it's an inference. And so, but because of that mode of vertical transmission, many people would argue that the fact that we see endogenous retroviruses in our genome and that there's corresponding sequences that occur in the corresponding location in the genomes of chimpanzees, gorillas, right. and orangutans, that this is clearly evidence for our evolutionary history or evolutionary origin. And I've had many people tell me that they think the most compelling evidence for human evolution is the distribution mm-hmm. of endogenous retroviruses among humans and the great apes.
And so the idea that they show up at the same location plays into that, because right. presumably this could have happened most anywhere. The fact that it all happened here
right.
says that it's all part of the same contingent event, as opposed to some orchestrated, this is where it always has to go type thing.
Yes, exactly, okay. exactly. And then in this diagram, what's also shown there is kind of a breakdown of the endogenous of a retroviral mm-hmm. DNA structure. And you have these things called long terminal repeats that are playing like a regulatory role as the viral genetic material is expressed. But there's also genes that encode for, you know, the capsid proteins, for other enzymes that will be incorporated into the viral capsid mm-hmm. that are playing a role in the next cycle of infection.
Right.
And so the question then is, how would somebody who holds to a creationist or an intelligent design view explain the, you know, endogenous retroviruses, right? How would you do that? Why would God create these retroviral or these sequences in the genome that look like, you know, they've arisen from retroviruses mm-hmm. and they're shared, again, among organisms that naturally group together? The best explanation is common descent, you know, the argument goes. And so, you know, this is, again, on the surface, a very powerful argument for common descent. And, you know, as somebody, again, who holds to a creation slash ID viewpoint, that what I would have to be able to do is, number one, demonstrate that these sequences are functional, right? Mm-hmm. Secondly, explain why these sequences would look like they originate from endogenous retroviruses. Mm-hmm. Why would there be that sequence similarity? And then finally, why would they occur in corresponding regions in genomes? So until you can account for all three of those, really common descent is the best explanation.
All right.
You know, and so one of the things that has happened, though, in the last, you know, probably 4 or 5 years, is that more and more people are recognizing that endogenous retroviruses are actually playing critical functional roles in the organism's biology. So
the DNA material or the genetic material that is incorporated from the viral infection actually serves purposes inside the host.
Yes. Yes. And so the way I would say it is the endogenous retroviral sequences, mm-hmm. independent of where they originate from, are playing functional roles. And the catalog of functions is actually growing to the point where now more and more scientists are not looking at them as junk, but actually are asking the question, what are these sequences doing? So there's a shift in mindset that I'm beginning to see. One of the functions that these sequences play is an anti-retroviral role. So, and there's a number of different mechanisms where these endogenous retroviral sequences can actually disrupt the process of endogenization. They can.
So because we've had this happen in the past, future viral infections we're going to be either immune to or significantly protected against.
Right, right. And so what happens is that when you have a retroviral infection, the endogenous retroviral sequences are expressed at high levels.
Okay.
And when they're expressed at high levels, they can either disrupt endogenization, protecting the genome from having viral material incorporated into it. They can inhibit the assembly of the viral capsid, and there's a number, it's mm-hmm. essentially competitive inhibition, and there's different ways that competitive inhibition can be carried out. It turns out that in the early stages of embryonic development, when there is no immune system, they're just cells, the embryo is highly vulnerable to retroviral infections.
Oh, okay.
And so you see endogenous retroviral sequences expressed at very high levels in the early stages, which, again, protect the embryo. There's some indication that these sequences can actually serve a role in preventing the spread of tumors.
Okay.
And there's also an interesting study done where people have shown that particular wasps who infect other, like caterpillars, will actually utilize endogenous retroviral sequences to impact the behavior of the caterpillar that's serving as the host. So there's all these different and all of these functions actually require that the endogenous retroviral sequence look like the sequence of a retroviral genetic material.
Because if it were too disparate, it just wouldn't. I mean, it wouldn't serve. It wouldn't serve
right.
the immunosuppressant role or whatever would happen.
In, right.
That's not the right term, but it wouldn't serve as
right.
immunity that it provides.
Yes, and so the in a sense these two criteria are being satisfied. Right, that it's functional, then that there's an explanation for why the sequence looks like
gotcha.
A retroviral sequence.
And is that why you made the distinction of a viral sequence that it looks like it came from, because
right.
that's whether it came from a virus or not, it looks like it did, and that's important.
Right.
Okay.
Right, because you could say that a creator intentionally designed those sequences to look like retroviral sequences because they were necessary for the particular role that they were going to play.
This may be jumping the gun or taking it in a different direction, and if it is, just tell me. But when you start talking about these things provide immunity against certain
right.
things, that given that we live in an environment that changes pretty dramatically, those sorts of features seem to be a mechanism to allow you to adapt to whatever things you're. So do we see any evidence that these retroviral sequences have changed or are different? Or I could, you know, it may be too short a time scale, but if you know, you go back 1,000 years and this was the type of virus we're exposed to, and now we're just exposed to something different, I could see where it might need to change over time, or it could be robust enough over the time scale of humanity. I'm curious your thoughts.
I don't think there's any evidence that the retroviral composition of the human genome has changed dramatically since we've been on Earth. But I do see it as being robust enough to handle exposure to new retroviruses.
Okay, so the fact that it's the same over the last, you know, few million years, if you incorporate the discussion with the chimpanzees and other things, that's like, it just works for that time frame. And so it's, that's not a discriminator one way or the other of looking at that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, well, and to the list that I've just described, we can add another function, and that's based on a paper that was just published, well, in January of this year, by a team from Spain, where they actually show that expression of endogenous retroviruses in, they're looking at a mouse embryos, but the expression of endogenous retroviruses in mouse embryos is playing a key transition or playing a key role in the transition of the embryo from the 2-cell to the 4-cell stage, where when that transition happens, you now have committed cell fates that are beginning to take place.
What do you mean by committed cell fates?
Well, let me go to this diagram, and that'll help us. So this is a cartoon showing some of the key stages in the early stages of embryonic development. So you have the egg cell that then gets fertilized by a sperm, and in the first day you have essentially two pronuclei from the sperm and from the egg that then fuse into a single nuclei, and at that point you have a zygote or a fertilized egg. And so what happens is at that point there's a series of cell divisions that take place. These are called cleavages, where you don't really see an increase in the size of the embryo. Mm-hmm. It's just the cell number increases. Okay. And so there's a series of cell divisions where you go to the 2-cell, 4-cell, 8-cell, 16-cell, and so on. And eventually you wind up with this structure called a marula, which is maybe 32 cells or 64 cells. It's a compact structure that looks like a berry, like a raspberry or a blackberry, covered by a membrane called the zona pellucida. And then you start to see some differentiation taking place where you get the trophoblast, which is going to become the placenta, and then you have the inner cell mass, which will be the true embryo as well as some other tissues that are necessary for the formation of the embryo proper, or the implantation of the embryo. So during that transition, you go from the zygote and the 2-cell stage, where those cells have the potential to develop into any one of the different cell types of the human body. And in fact, at the 2-cell stage, if you pulled the 2 cells apart, each would become an embryo.
Okay.
So that's called totipotency, or they have total potential. When you go from the 2-cell to the 4-cell stage, you now have the cell fate committed, where the cells can develop into any of the different cell types in the human body, but they no longer are able to develop into an entirely new embryo if they're broken apart. Right?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so what's happening is, as you go from the zygote through the 2-cell stage to the 4-cell stage, there's changes in gene expression patterns that are taking place, changes in what are called epigenetic modifications of the genome. So you go from a zygotic state to an embryonic state, and that embryonic state first appears at the 4-cell stage.
Okay.
So it's a transition that involves all kinds of biochemical changes that's quite elaborate. And if that transition happened abruptly, it would be incomplete and would probably mean death for the embryo. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have enough time for that transition to happen smoothly and completely.
The right. time between the two and the four?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So you've got to have something that slows the whole process down. So these researchers are trying to understand what is the biochemical mechanism mm-hmm. that's involved in that transition from totipotency to pluripotency, from the two-cell to the four-cell stage. And so they had a collection of observations that they were working with. One is that there are these two proteins that are called transcription factors called SOX2 and OCT4 that are playing a critical role in that transition. Mm-hmm. They're turning on and turning off genes and probably impacting epigenetic modification indirectly that's, you know, facilitating that transition. They also note that in the mouse embryo, there are a large number of endogenous retroviral sequences that fall into a class called the MERVL sequences.
Okay.
And they are not only large in number in the genome, but they are expressed at a high level at the two-cell stage.
Hmm.
They also note in that, in fact, if you inhibit the expression of those endogenous retroviral sequences, the embryo dies.
Okay.
So they're obviously playing some kind of important role. And interestingly enough, if you at the four-cell stage, if you express the endogenous retroviral sequences, the MERVL sequences, it'll actually revert the embryo to the two-cell stage. Hmm. So its biochemistry will look like a two-cell stage biochemistry, not the okay. four-cell stage. There's another protein called UR1. No, check that. URI. That is belongs to a category of proteins called prefoldins. And as the name implies, it essentially binds to proteins and keeps them stable, keeps them from unfolding.
Okay.
And it turns out that you have to have URI expressed to protect SOX2 and OCT4. So it's kind of like a protector mm-hmm. keeping those transcription factors functioning. Otherwise, if URI isn't expressed, you end up, the cell's machinery breaks down, mm-hmm. SOX2 and OCT4, you can't get the transition to the next stage of embryogenesis. So what these researchers did is a series of really elegant experiments where they basically showed that what's going on mm-hmm. is that SOX2 and OCT4 are, again, expressed.
These are the retroviral.
No, these are the transcription factors.
Transcription factor. Okay.
But if left to their own devices, the transition would happen too rapidly,
okay.
and that would lead to embryonic death. So the endogenous retroviruses are expressed, and when they are expressed, they are actually producing a protein called the GAG protein, which is one of the proteins that would form a retroviral mm-hmm. capsid. And that ends up interacting with the URI protein, inhibiting its activity,
okay.
which means SOX2 and OCT4 get broken down. So in other words, it's like a braking mechanism that slows down mm-hmm. the entry into the four-cell stage long enough so that you can reset the gene expression, the cell can, you know, alter its epigenetic patterning mm-hmm. so that it's now ready to smoothly enter and completely enter into that four-cell stage. And so as soon as that process is completed, the endogenous retroviral sequences are no longer expressed, and the URI can then bind and stabilize the SOX2 and OCT4 proteins, and the transition happens, and away you go to the races with embryonic development. So
unless I'm missing something here, it almost sounds like without these endogenous retroviral sequences in there, the process of fertilization to growth doesn't work.
Yes.
So how ubiquitous is that? I mean, you're talking about mice here. You're not yeah. talking about chimpanzees and humans. It's almost like you've got to have the endogenous retroviral stuff in there, which would mean you'd see that kind of
right.
universally across some level of organisms.
Yeah. I mean, well, the fact that you see this mechanism in mice suggests that it's probably a mechanism that applies to all of mammalia.
Okay.
So that this is probably a mechanism that's in play in all mammals, including chimpanzees and humans, right? Because they argue that this has got to be a very ancient mechanism that would have appeared at the very beginnings of the appearance of placental mammals, maybe even appeared earlier in animal history.
Well, yeah, it almost strikes if you don't have that, you don't get mammal development.
Yes.
I don't know what the most extensive part of that, but it's like, at least if you talk about manuals, you're just not going to get mammals because you don't make that transition from fertilized to four stage and up.
Right.
Well.
Right. And so this is another example where not only are the ERV sequences functional, and this is a new type of function compared to other functions that have been identified, but that the function depends upon the sequence similarity to the GAG protein. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because GAG is a protein that interacts with other proteins to form the capsid.
Right.
And so it's going to naturally interact with things like URI, to keep it from, again, interacting with the SOX2 and the OCT4 proteins. And then the fact that you see ERV sequences that are shared makes sense now because they're going to be doing the same type of function. So all three criteria are met. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that the case for common descent is undermined, but what it does mean is that you can legitimately, from a design perspective, look at the occurrence of ERV sequences and argue that they could very well have been intentionally designed into the human genome or the genomes of other animals to play these kinds of critical roles. And again, it's very similar to what you were describing with all these Earth processes, because you have simultaneously the expression of ERV sequences, right, that are not only serving an antiretroviral role, but are also actually now regulating embryonic development. So they're actually serving multiple purposes at the same time.
Right.
And then that expression is shut down at the just right times to allow embryonic development to take place. And it's also shut down at the just right time because if you have ongoing retroviral in expression, it's going to actually cause insertion events disrupting the genome.
Okay.
So it's, these just right things happening at the just right time. So to me, and you touched upon it in your comment, or your previous comment where you said, if it doesn't happen, if these aren't expressed, if they're not there in the genome, you're not going to get mammals, right? And so to me, the fact that you have such an integrated system. So it's an integrated complexity that's necessary for embryonic development. It's hard to envision how something like that could have emerged in a stepwise manner. You've got to have everything working in a coherent, just right manner for all of this to work. That looks to me like design, like there's an intentionality to it. And there's just the ingenuity and the elegance of this also, I think, points to design as well.
I don't know. You made a statement that, okay, at least from a common design perspective, we can explain why this is there. And I think that's true. But there is, and I don't know how to articulate it, so I'm going to fumble around with it a little bit. But, if the advent of mammals hinges on the retroviral infection, it's like, that's already a big change to start with to go from wherever you were to mammals. I mean, it's just a pretty... that it seems like it almost stretches credulity a little bit to think not only did you have all this other stuff, but there's this piece, if the viral infection doesn't happen at just the right time, you're not going to get mammals in the first place. And maybe that's the contingent nature of evolution that people point to. But it would certainly argue that I'm not going to expect this anywhere else in the universe.
Right.
Because that's a remarkable event.
Right.
That... unless you're going to argue there's intelligence can happen outside of mammals, I guess maybe the argument's a little more nuanced than what I'm portraying there. But that seems very foundational piece that's going on here.
So. Yeah, I mean that's good intuition. I would agree with that, and I think your point too, which is a very interesting point, that that this, that if there's life out there, this mm-hmm. seems like a highly rare event, mm-hmm. you know, where we got lucky, right? Mm-hmm. And how, you know, is that nobody else is going to get lucky in that way. So, you know, interesting point.
Yeah. This is cool. There's a reason why I went into astrophysics and not biology, but this is mind-blowing. I mean,
yeah, this is why I love biochemistry. But, you know, and here's a, just to close it out, here's just a great quote from one of the researchers. Until recently, these viral remnants were considered to be junk DNA, genetic material that was unusable or even harmful. Intuitively, it was thought that having viruses in the genome could not be good. However, in recent years, we are starting to realize that these retroviruses have important functions, such as regulating other genes.
Right.
So, which is exactly what they've discovered. So, anyway, we live in a just right universe, and we've got these just right processes and living systems that point to a creator.
So. And we've got the just right amount of water where it can all happen too.
So. That's right. All right, well, thanks so much for joining us on today's episode of Star Cells and God. Love to hear your comments. Please enter into the discussion by putting your comments below the video. And remember that if you go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, you can subscribe to this video. You can subscribe to our station, our YouTube channel, and get access to all kinds of great videos. Use the notification button to subscribe to this podcast, and also follow us on social media, RTB_official. And remember, until next time, the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe.